¿Cómo estás? ¿Tú también? Welcome to All Crime, No Cattle, a Texas true crime podcast. I'm one half of this podcast. I am Shay. The other half is who is presenting today's case, and that is...
My name is Erin, and that intro was very apropos because today we're going to be reading international reviews at the end of the podcast. Very exciting.
Excellent.
Yes. Well, today, before we begin, we wanted to make sure everybody was up to date with the podcast meeting that is being held here in Texas. It's going to be in Dallas at, what is the place called again, Shay?
Yeah, it's going to be at the Will Call Bar in Deep Ellum in Dallas. And this is the old Liquid Lounge, if you're familiar with that particular club in Dallas. It's going to be Saturday, April 21st at 7 p.m., The podcasts that are going to be there are going to include Nature of the Beast, Dark Divide, True Crime Fan Club, Swindled, a big podcast right now. We're super excited for them to be there. Secret Transmission, Whiskey Boy Radio, Texas 1031, possibly Gone Cold. We're hoping they can show up. We're thinking they're going to be there. And there's also obviously going to be probably some other Texas podcasts that may or may not join up. We're thinking that there are going to be a couple, but most of all, we're going to have stickers.
Most of all, we're going to be there.
Yeah. Most of all.
Which is enough reason for you to want to come anyway.
Exactly. We're going to be there. We're ready to receive your questions about previous episodes, to welcome you into the True Crime
Posse.
You can
yell at us in person.
Yeah, totally. but we will have stickers and buttons, and we're also going to raffle off one of our sweet, sweet tote bags. So. Be there or be freaking square.
It's going to be great. I hope so.
So enough about that, Erin. Let's talk about what we have coming up in the next couple of weeks for this podcast. We're going to do what I'm referring to as a double-double. That's what we're doing in these Lone Star Lunatic series that are coming up. So we got two, count them, one, two Lone Star Lunatic series that are coming up for you. What do we know about the first one that you're going to talk about?
Well, the first one starts today, and it's going to be about the Texas Seven.
Oh.
Exciting.
Yeah, and so you're probably going to feel a theme coming up with these two series. It's something to do with getting out of prison, so to speak, one way or another.
One way legally, one way illegally.
Exactly. All right, so yep. If you're ready, I'm ready. Let's hit it.
Let's begin. All right. Well, let's begin episode 17. This episode is about the prison break of the Texas Seven, which happened in December of 2000. This is actually our first listener requested episode we've done. This came from an iTunes review, actually. So thanks so much to Leslie0902, who said, I love an episode of the Texas Seven. My cousin's uniform was taken and he was tied up and thrown in a closet during their escape. Regardless, thank you for a fun Texas show. Well, thank you, Leslie0902. Yeah. I saw your review a few weeks ago when it was first posted, and I thought it would be a really cool case to study up on and present on the show. It is a little bit of a change of pace, a little something new.
Yeah, a little different.
To give you guys. Yeah. And what's cool about it is I remember when this happened. I mean, I was 15. And you were 16, I guess.
Yeah.
When this happened, it was, of course, very alarming for us in North Texas, as we'll get into in the podcast, and you'll see why. I didn't really know any of the details.
Yeah, me either.
Yeah. It was just something that was on our news. Hey, be worried about this happening. But I don't really remember keeping up with it at all. I mean, we were 15, 16 years old at the time. We didn't keep up with that kind of stuff.
Details were getting, you know, sprinkled out as they came. And it just made more of us who were north of the area more terrified as the Texas Seven were coming closer and closer to our area. I remember that. I remember like a sense of impending doom as these maniac escape prisoners were coming closer and closer to DFW.
Oh, yes. So thank you to Leslie0902. If you have anything to share about the case at all, or if you can get some more background from your cousin, which would be phenomenal, especially given a lot of the background of the case as far as the prison workers are concerned. Drop us an email or contact us through any of our social media, and maybe we can send you a sticker or something for your fantastic recommendation.
Yeah.
All right, so let's begin with our sources as we do every episode. Now, there's tons of information out there in various forms about the Texas Seven. The most comprehensive source that I use was the book The Texas Seven, A True Story of Murder and a Daring Escape by Gary C. King. Some of the court documents I was able to read from courttv.com, which are still housed on the Wayback Machine website, which is a digital archive of old websites and digital information. So you can find that information there.
You had to go all the way back there, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. And that included the Texas Department of Criminal Justice's Serious Incident Review that was put together just a few days after the prison escape and has a lot of firsthand accounts of the prison workers and the COs who described exactly what happened the day of the escape. There's also an episode of the National Geographic Channel show Breakout, which is available on YouTube. It's very sort of sensationalized, but it's a fun little, you know, self-contained episode about the show. And Werner Herzog, in his series Death Row, he interviewed two of the escapees, Joseph Garcia and George Rivas. This was a really excellent and I think unbiased presentation of the facts, and I'd really recommend anyone to go watch it. And finally, there are tons of different articles about the Texas Seven online, and I will pepper those references and sources that had pertinent information on this case sort of throughout this episode and the following one, because this is a two-parter, because I hate myself, apparently.
I know immediately after this, I'm going to go watch the Werner Herzog documentary, because I love everything he does. He's amazing.
It was really good. It was really good. I would highly recommend. All right. Are you ready to dig in?
Dude, I'm ready. I'm ready to get out of this prison and figure out how it was a max facility, right? So like.
It was.
Ooh, God, I can't even imagine how you get out of a max facility. I'm so excited.
That's what all this episode is about the actual breakout.
Let's do it.
So this case starts in the John B. Connolly Unit, a prison located just 2 miles outside of Kennedy, Texas. This is Kennedy spelled with one N.
Okay.
It's a tiny town about 60 miles south of San Antonio. Kennedy was named for a businessman named Mifflin Kennedy, who basically bought a huge tract of land in the area specifically to develop a town to name after himself.
Wow. Okay.
It's a weird thing to want to do, but you know, I'm not a rich businessman. Maybe that's normal for them.
If you got that kind of cash floating around, buy a town.
Why not? Some people get billboards with their names on it. Sometimes you buy a tract of land and build a town on it.
It's such like an old West thing to do.
It really is. So the town of Kennedy itself has a bit of a sordid history. In the early 20th century, it had a huge number of gunfights on the streets, and it was thus nicknamed the Six Shooter Junction, which to me is a much better name than Kennedy.
God, that would have been a great name for our podcast, Six Shooter Junction.
Oh my God, it would have been. What have we done with our lives?
Oh man, I love it.
So there's that. Also in World War II, it housed an internment camp for German, Italian, and Japanese descended people, many of whom were U.S. citizens. Oh, so not great. Not great.
It is a sordid past.
Exactly. The population of Kennedy itself sits just north of about 3,000 people, and the John Connolly unit housed about 2,800 prisoners. So the population of the prison was almost equal to the population of the nearby town.
Jesus.
Yeah, a little insane. But that is Texas for you.
It's like an impending terror, you know, of like, our town is only as big as the prison that's nearby. What if they all got out?
Yeah, it is a little worrisome. The John B. Connolly unit is a maximum security state prison. It is completely surrounded by a 12-foot fence topped with razor wire. It has 3 perimeter pickets with armed officers. It also had about 300 corrections officers, or COs, with about 100 on duty at any given time.
Now, a picket, is that like a tower?
We're going to talk about what pickets mean a little bit later.
Okay.
Believe me, I'm going to give you a full description of what that means. Cool. But they also had 3 guard towers
that were right outside these picket gate areas. Okay.
Yeah. There was also 1 armed patrol vehicle that would make its rounds around the compound. Most of the prisoners housed inside the prison had been charged with very violent crimes and were looking at decades-long sentences.
Yeah, a high-security prison. I mean, violent criminals.
Yeah, absolutely. And you also have to take into account that this is Texas. So we imprison more people than basically any other state.
and
in the country and probably anywhere else in the world. So you have a lot of people serving a long, long time. Yeah. We have a focus on punishment and not rehabilitation. And we're going to get into some of those themes here in a little bit later in this episode and also in next episode as well, because I do want to talk about those things. After the escape, a memo was leaked to the media from the Texas Department of Criminal Justice, which clearly placed the blame on the escape on the corrections officers and the other prison workers in the attack. But the fact of the matter is, the escape showed clear administrative problems within the prison and within the Texas prison system overall, including problems with understaffing, inexperienced workers, and very low pay. In fact, at the time, and probably today, although I don't know that for sure, but Texas prison workers were some of the lowest paid in the nation. And I saw stats as in we were, out of all of the 50 states in the United States, we were 47th in paying our prison workers. And it was at the time, I believe this was a quote at the time, but it was about $18,000 a year.
Wow.
Now, in today's figures, we can probably bump up a few thousand just with inflation, cost of living and everything. But we're still talking about men and women who are dealing with inmates who are regularly sentenced to long stints in jail, where the focus is, again, on punishment and not on rehabilitation, who are basically making minimum wage.
Yeah, you know, we've got listeners out there who have already talked about that they're in law enforcement. It'd be curious to see if we have listeners out there who have worked in prisons and have been in these kind of situations.
That would be really interesting. If you work in a prison and you're willing to talk about it, of course, we would maintain your anonymity and everything, but that would be very interesting for you to shoot us a message about it. Well, amongst these inmates was a group of seven men who joined together and executed an elaborate escape plan. These men would come to be known as the Texas Seven. Now, each of these guys was a hardened criminal, worthy of their own episode of this show before their escape. So I will quickly go over what they did to get them into this maximum security prison. First up is George Rivas, the ringleader of the group. Rivas was an intelligent and born leader, but he was also bold and arrogant. And honestly, these are pretty excellent qualities in a criminal. Rivas was 30 years old at the time, and as a child growing up in El Paso, he had wanted to be a police officer.
Oh, you don't say.
Mm-hmm. But he had started robbing basically straight out of high school, and he went on to be involved in a large string of robberies. Werner Herzog called him a gentleman robber. He developed some ploy to basically gather all employees of a business together, announce the robbery, and then take what he wanted. The robberies were carefully planned and executed in a style that we will see later on after the escape. He was serving 18 life sentences for 13 counts of aggravated kidnapping with a deadly weapon and 4 counts of robbery with a deadly weapon and 1 count of burglary of a habitation.
That's a resume right there.
It sure was. Now, his first conviction got him 10 life sentences because he was charged with individual counts of kidnapping for asking the employees of the business he was robbing to move from one part of the store to another. Huh. Rivas contends that this was a prime example for the problems of the justice system, as he suggested that the kidnapping charges were trumped up charges that artificially inflated his sentence, making him serve more time than even violent murderers.
I kind of agree with him.
I kind of do too. He told Werner Herzog that, quote, "they took away all hope from me." And this was the primary reason that he wanted to escape. Rivas began hatching the plan of escape long before it came to fruition, and he approached the men who he knew he could trust, he knew were capable criminals, and he knew were well-liked by guards, and that similarly longed to get out of prison.
It makes sense, and I imagine he probably had some narcissistic characteristics going on. Maybe a little sociopathy, that where he can control other people and gain power over others, you know, and like bend them to his will.
They have these interviews with Rivas and a lot of the other characters out there, and you can watch them. Some people watch them and say, I feel for them. I see their humanity. And I feel that way in some cases. But with Rivas, I see a little bit of the blunt affect that you get with like serial killers.
Yeah.
I feel like he's faking a lot of his grief, or
yeah, well, it's like cold calculation. Like you can see the dice falling, like, as he's talking, where it's almost like, okay, they've given me no other choice but try to escape. Exactly. They've trumped up my charges. How can I do this? How can I get out? How can I push people to join my cause?
Absolutely. And I think with Revis, he's not like a serial killer type. He's not like one of these people who is just the absolute, he's on the edge of humanity where he's not even human. He will kill and maim everything he comes into contact with because that's the only way he knows how to live. He's not like that. But I think he's a guy who he'll kill you if you get in his way.
Yeah, or maybe...
And it doesn't really bother him that much. I think that that's the kind of guy Revis was.
And maybe moreover than that, maybe like at the core of that, he's a social engineer where he knows how to manipulate people.
Absolutely.
He knows
how... And I think we'll see that a lot.
Okay. All right.
Absolutely. So his kind of second in command is Michael Rodriguez. At the time, he was 38 years old. He came from San Antonio. He had actually been a very successful and fairly well-off restaurant owner. In 1992, he was convicted of orchestrating the murder of his wife, Teresa, after he fell in love with a younger woman. He was set to rake in about $300,000 in her life insurance policies, $2,000 of which would pay off the hitman, an ex-con named Roland Ruiz. So again, he was going to pay. Somebody accepted the job to murder a person for $2,000.
Wow.
Which is shocking. Now, the authorities figured out the ploy pretty quickly, thankfully, and Rodriguez was sentenced to 99 years to life.
And she survived his wife.
No, she did not.
Oh.
So Ruiz, who shot and killed Teresa, was sentenced to capital murder, and he was eventually executed back in March of 2017. Oh, so last
that's
year.
Terrible.
Mm-hmm. Now, here's a little weird tidbit about this. According to the prosecutor, Shook, who's going to come up in the later events of the story.
Wait, his name is Shook?
Shook, S-H-O-O-K.
It's like a rapper name.
Prosecutor Shook. So anyways, now according to this prosecutor, Rodriguez was gay and was in love with Revis. Now, when I read this, it was just stated as fact. And the prosecutor just said it, and it was just like the article continued on. And I thought, well, clearly there's some background or information to this. I have not seen this storyline referenced anywhere else that I've seen. So I'm definitely going to maybe go back and look over the court documents and see what it was. I don't know if that was maybe a part of Rodriguez's defense or I don't know what it is. I haven't seen it anywhere else. I just know that the prosecutor apparently thinks that there was some weird love story going on between this men. I don't know.
Just a bullet pointed fact that he had. Okay.
Exactly. Right. That I haven't seen anywhere else.
So we're taking that with a grain of salt. Got it.
So I will continue to research and I will present that information next episode. Next up is Joseph Garcia. He was 29 years old and from San Antonio. In 1996, he was driving another man, Miguel Luna, home when Luna and him started fighting over a woman that they both had a thing for. According to Garcia, Luna attacked him as he was driving, and he was barely able to pull over before Luna choked him out and he lost consciousness. He awoke to see Luna pacing back and forth outside of the vehicle, and he had stolen the car keys. Garcia said he got out of the car, he pulled out a knife that he had had on him, and told Luna to give him the keys. Luna ran to a nearby apartment building, where Garcia said Luna continued to refuse to give him the keys, and then pulled back his fist to punch him. Garcia contends that he defended himself with a knife and ended up stabbing and killing Luna. Now, Garcia's claims of self-defense were somewhat undercut by the fact that, one, he stabbed Luna 19 times. And two, while stabbing Luna to death, witnesses heard him yell out, "Die, motherfucker, die." Garcia was actually offered a plea deal to serve only 15 years, but he rejected it, choosing instead to go to trial, where he was found guilty of murder and sentenced to 50 years.
You stabbed him a lot.
It was a whole lot.
That's not, man, I don't know. I teach.
At that point, it's no longer self-defense. From someone, stab somebody 19 times.
From someone who teaches weapon defense and self-defense, this is well beyond self-defense.
Exactly. And I think that the jury figured that out as well. Next up is Randy Halprin. He was the youngest of the group at 23 years old. Halprin had been raised by abusive, druggy parents before eventually being adopted by what seemed like a really nice family who did their best to raise him right. However, he started doing drugs and stealing from an early age. In August of 1996, he was living in Arlington, Texas, with a group of people he'd met at a homeless shelter. One day, he was left alone with one of his roommate's 18-month-old son. High on LSD and annoyed by the baby's crying, he proceeded to beat and kick the child and ended up breaking both of the baby's arms and legs, fracturing his skull, and rupturing his eardrum. The baby lived, but had, of course, severe injuries from this attack. Now, he at first blamed the abuse on the child's mother, but eventually he admitted to the beating after failing a polygraph. There were also burns on the baby's tongue, consistent with burns from either matches or cigarettes. But Halperin never admitted to this part of the child abuse. He was serving a 30-year sentence for injury to a child.
Wait, okay. Oh my god. Okay, so like this guy is already my most deplorable inmate.
Well, just wait. Because we got some other bad ones.
But F Randy is what I'm going to say.
Yeah.
God.
Mm-hmm. I have a lot of these guys, to be quite honest with you. Next up is Patrick Murphy Jr. He was 39 years old and grew up in Dallas. He was sentenced to 50 years for aggravated sexual assault with a deadly weapon and burglary after breaking into a woman's house who he had known in high school, robbing her, and raping her. Next up is Donald Newberry. 38 years old, he had committed multiple robberies and was known as the I-35 robber for a string of robberies along Interstate I-35. This was his third conviction for aggravated robbery and aggravated robbery with a deadly weapon, and he was now serving 99 years in prison. Newberry had previously attempted to break out of jail back in 1987 at the Travis County Jail, where he and two others overpowered two COs and took them hostage. However, that escape failed.
Interesting. So he's becoming like an interesting person in this prison break scenario. Like, he's tried before. He's totally interesting.
Yeah. And technically Michael Rodriguez had also kind of tried to escape a prison break at some point, but it was like he was on his own and he tried to hide out in one of the buildings and like walk out or something. It was very simple, not planned.
But he had shown an interest.
Absolutely. Now, our first horrible person.
Oh, this is the first horrible person?
Our final horrible person is Larry Harper. He was 37 years old. He had been an honors student at the University of Texas at El Paso. During the years of 1993 and 1994, he tied up and violently raped three women. His reasoning was that he was depressed because his girlfriend broke up with him. Poor guy.
That's why he did that to three women?
Mm-hmm. Now, in between the second and third victims, he had twice been caught peeping in on women who were home alone with items that, to me, look pretty much like a rape kit. He had a screwdriver, tape, scissors, etc. Yet he never served jail time on either one of those occasions. And his third victim was one of the women he had been caught peeping on. So he actually doubled back and ended up raping her for his third conviction.
Finished his work.
Wow. He was serving three concurrent 50-year sentences and six concurrent 30-year sentences for aggravated sexual assault. Well, yeah, this is the Texas Seven. We have robbers, child abusers, rapists. Honestly, a group of guys who well deserve their sentences for being dangerous to society. So now let's move on to the escape. But before we start, I want to mention that we obviously have seven men here who are enacting this plan to escape the prison. Don't worry too much about their names or keeping track of who did what, because it's really not that important. What I want you to know is that these seven men came together and they kind of acted as one. They acted as a team and they were all intimately involved in this breakout and in everything that happened beyond it as well. Now, it's obvious that the seven men carefully planned the escape attempt, but how long they planned is a little bit debated. Some of the escapees said that they took about 6 months to plan the escape, with Halperin saying that Rivas had approached him about as early as April. Rivas, however, says that the planning only took about 6 weeks. Either way, it's clear that they made note of policies that weren't being followed by COs and prison supervisors. They assessed daily events and procedures that left an opening for them to enact their plan, and they observed other faults or weaknesses in security that they could exploit. Together, they developed a three-part plan of escape. Number one, to take over the maintenance department of the prison and incapacitate any other individuals in the building. Number two, to secure the guardhouse and tower. And number three, to open the gate to the compound and drive away in one of the prison's maintenance vehicles. And on Wednesday, December 13th, 2000, they put their plan into action. The prison's maintenance department was a large building that housed four separate areas: a front office, a shop, a warehouse, and an electrical room at the back of the building. The maintenance department was usually closed an hour a day during lunchtime, meaning that most prisoners wouldn't be inside the building at this time, and it wouldn't typically be monitored as closely by guards. On this day, however, Rivas, Garcia, Halperin, Harper, Newberry, and Murphy had offered to wax and seal the floors and had made arrangements to eat their lunches inside the department. This was considered a perk that wasn't usually given to prisoners. However, these six were considered agreeable inmates who had no history of assaultive or violent behavior, at least towards the guards, and were therefore sometimes afforded special treatment. One maintenance supervisor offered to stay behind and watch the inmates while the other supervisors went to lunch. Now, on top of it being lunchtime, some bad weather had also restricted normal outdoor activity in the area, meaning that the maintenance department was even more isolated than usual. So I wanted to know, what does bad weather in Texas mean? Because we know as Texans, and especially as me, I used to live in Alaska, so I have a little bit of a disparity between what bad weather is in Alaska versus in Texas. So I wanted to know, what does bad weather in Texas in December mean to these people? And I looked up the historical weather data and found out, now this information is coming from San Antonio, which is the next largest big city. But what I found out was the temperature was between 37 and 39 degrees Fahrenheit. That's about 2 to 4 degrees Celsius on that day. For our international listeners, there had been some light freezing rain earlier that morning where it was actually below freezing, and a little bit of a drizzle throughout the late morning, but by noon the rain had stopped. And I think this tells you how badly Texans react to a fairly cold day, that normal prison activity would go to a standstill with a little bit of a chill in the air.
Yeah.
Remember, it's above freezing, it's just kind of like cloudy and nasty out, but we still had all of this activity outside kind of stopped because it was like 39 degrees or so.
I'm sure all of our Texas listeners know exactly what we're talking about. Yeah. When
Texans
get a little,
aren't great with a little bit of bad weather. Cold.
No. I'm sure Northerners or like our listeners in Iceland will think this is laughable. But when it gets down to freezing rain and it's like the first freezing rain event or even like one of the last, like we go crazy. Mm. And like schools shut down, like government facilities shut down.
If there's the slightest bit of a freeze or a little bit of sleet on the road, things get shut down here in Texas.
It's a late start.
Exactly. So this is kind of the situation that we're getting this day. Now, the seventh man, Michael Rodriguez, had been assigned to yard duties outside, but those duties had been canceled because of the weather. So he was pretty much free to do whatever he wanted that morning. He was able to get to the maintenance area by lying to the guards, telling them that he had been assigned to pick up trash in the area. He then spent the rest of the morning on a bench just outside the maintenance department where many employees saw him but didn't check to see what the hell he was doing out there.
He's just hanging out on a bench?
Yep. And turns out what he was doing there was serving as a lookout as the plan inside the building was put into action.
Wow.
At 11:30 a.m., Rivas went into the front office area where the one remaining supervisor was and told him he was needed in the warehouse. The supervisor and Rivas went into the warehouse where the other remaining prisoners were clearing the floor in order to begin waxing and sealing it. Harper asked the supervisor what they should do with a large motor that was located underneath a table, as they would need to move it to access the floor underneath it. As the supervisor bent over to look at the motor, one of the prisoners hit him on the back of the head with the handle of an axe.
Wow.
So we're starting off great here.
Where did he get a handle from an axe?
That's a good question. I actually don't know.
Is that just an item that we're allowing prisoners to walk around with and hang out with?
I guess so.
What are you doing with that handle of the axe? Just waxing the floor.
Well, days from the blow, the supervisor began to fight off the prisoner surrounding him until Garcia put the blade of a homemade knife against his neck and told him, "A few more years to her sentence don't mean nothing to us. We'll kill you if we need to." The prisoners removed his pants and shirt, taking all the items and money on him, as well as the keys to the facility. They bound his hands and legs, put a gag into his mouth, and shoved a pillowcase over his head. They carried him to the electrical room in the back of the warehouse, where they told him to lay face down on the ground. They then took two Texas Department of Criminal Justice coats from the office, which they now had the keys to. They armed themselves with tools and items from the storage facility, which they also had access to now with the keys. And they allowed Michael Rodriguez into the building.
Who was the lookout on the
bench.
Who
had been the lookout, yeah. At 11:45, another supervisor and a corrections officer returning from lunch entered the front office of the maintenance building. Rivas, Halperin, Harper, Murphy, and Newberry went into the office and started chatting with them. Murphy and Garcia distracted the supervisor by asking him about a part needed to repair a vacuum cleaner, while Rivas positioned himself behind the supervisor and Garcia moved behind the CO. At the same time, they both attacked, grabbing the two men from behind and forcing them to the floor. They removed the CO's uniform and bound his arms and legs with zip ties and duct tape.
Oh my gosh.
But when they tried to gag the CO, he refused to open his mouth, so Newberry punched him hard in the nose. They were able to gag him, steal his ID card, wallet, and cash, and put him in the electrical room. At the same time, the supervisor continued to struggle with the other inmates until Garcia put a sharp blade into his ear and told him he'd shove it all the way in if the man continued to resist. Now, obviously, this was enough to make the man comply, sure. And the prisoners again took off his jeans and boots, stole his wallet, ID, and keys. They then took him back into the electrical room and slammed his head against the wall, knocking him unconscious. Again, they placed a pillowcase around his head and wrapped duct tape around the pillowcase around his eyes and left him in the electrical room. At this point, they had successfully captured three men.
Jeez.
At noon, two other supervisors came in and entered the front office. Rivas went into the office and told one of the men that the first supervisor, the one who was supposed to be watching them and was now tied up in the electrical room, needed him in the warehouse. As the supervisor entered the warehouse, Halperin called out to him, asking him if he could come take a look at this motor underneath the table.
Yeah.
We've heard about that before. The supervisor started towards Halperin when he was struck in the back of the head with the axe handle. He lost consciousness for just a moment, but when he woke up, he felt three blades poking into his skin at the back of his neck, his lower back, and in his armpit. He heard Rivas say, "This is no joke. We go home and you go home, or not. It's up to you." Halperin again removed the man's clothing, tied his hands and feet, gagged him, and threw him into the electrical closet with the others.
I'm just guessing that this has to be, it sounds very old school on a prison escape, how they keep drawing guards and people of like the next level into their area that they have control over and dealing with them and securing them. It's got to be something that like correctional officers train for, right? It just seems.
But the majority of the people that they were actually taking captive were maintenance supervisors who have no security or defensive training.
Okay.
Yeah. Rivas then called in the supervisor who is still sitting in the front office area, telling him that the other supervisor needed help. As he walked into the warehouse, Newberry and Rivas grabbed him from behind, forced him to the floor, and again removed his clothing, relieved him of his belongings, bound and gagged him, carried him to the electrical room, where they placed a pillowcase over his head and left him there. At 12:20, another prison worker, this one a recreational program specialist, entered the office and found Rivas, Halperin, and Murphy sitting unsupervised in the office. He asked the prisoners where the supervisor was, and they told him he'd been called to the dorms, but would be back in just a second. This was, of course, against policy to leave any prisoners unsupervised for any length of time, but it happened often enough that it didn't really strike this guy as that big of a deal. He told the prisoners he needed to check out a toolbox. The prisoners brought him the toolbox and the sign-out sheet, and the guy left. Rivas started to follow him out, thinking that just maybe he should go ahead and add him to their growing pile of hostages, but the guy just ended up leaving. About 5 minutes later, a group of three maintenance supervisors came in. One went into the office, one went into the shop, and the third went into the warehouse. So basically, they split themselves up and enabled the prisoners to take them down one at a time.
How many maintenance workers does this prison have?
A whole lot, apparently. Jeez. Newberry asked the supervisor who went into the warehouse to come and look at something on a shelf. As soon as he bent over, Newberry grabbed him from behind and put him into a headlock. Revis helped to shove the man to the ground and tried gagging him, but again, this man refused to open his mouth. Revis punched him twice in the nose and was able to successfully gag him, but he continued to struggle with his attackers until one of the prisoners put a blade fashioned out of sharpened plexiglass to the back of his head. They then took off his clothes, bound him, shoved the pillowcase on, duct taped the pillowcase around his eyes, and shoved him back into the electrical room with the others. With the first guy taken down, Harper went into the office where the second supervisor was and asked him to come into the warehouse to look at a motor.
The same motor?
The same damn motor. As he walked in, Revis attacked him from behind and put a blade to his throat. Halpin and Harper helped to get the man to the ground, and guess what they did?
They gagged him, and then they put a pillowcase over him, they duct taped him, they took his clothes off, and they put him in the electrical room.
Yes.
All right, yeah. That's
exactly right.
I'm sensing a pattern.
Exactly. Now, for the third guy of the group, who was in the shop, Garcia went in to ask the supervisor if he wanted something to eat, hoping to goad the man into coming into the warehouse. However, the supervisor said no. If it were me, I'd be like, yeah, I want something to eat. Come on. I'd be like running.
But then again, like, what kind of snacks do prisoners have? Like,
well, as far as I know, this is stuff that they had accumulated from their commissary.
Oh.
So it was probably like pretty good snacks, I guess, as opposed to like regular prison food.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the supervisor said no. So rethinking their trap, Murphy then went into the shop and told the man he was needed in the warehouse. Easier story, right? Immediately upon entering the warehouse, he was attacked. Halpern told him he wouldn't be hurt if he didn't resist. As if to paint the picture that resistance would be futile anyway, Garcia and Newberry held blades behind each one of his ears. And then they, say it with me, removed his clothes, bound him, gagged him, put the pillowcase and duct tape around his head, and then threw him in the electrical closet.
I couldn't do it that fast.
Well, yes. If you're keeping count, the seven men were about an hour into their escape plan, and so far they had taken eight men captive.
Eight men in an hour.
You might think they're done, but they're not.
Well, I'm just saying they're very resourceful.
They really are. And they have a very consistent plan of what they're doing with each minute they're taking hostage.
Wow.
At 12:40, another supervisor came into the maintenance department along with two prisoners. Revis told the supervisor that he was needed in the warehouse, and the two prisoners went into the office to wait. As soon as the supervisor came into the warehouse, several of the prisoners attacked him, held a knife to his head, tied him up, gagged him, put a pillowcase around his head, and put him into the electrical room.
I mean, how much square footage is the electrical room? Are we running out of space at this point?
I would think so. I would think so, because there are a lot of people in there right now. Murphy then went into the office where the two prisoners not involved in the escape were waiting for their escort. He told them there was food in the back of the warehouse and for them to help themselves. One immediately got up, this would have been me, and went into the warehouse to get the food, where Revis punched him in the face, and another man hit him in the back of the head with the axe handle. The other inmate hadn't taken the bait, so he was like, oh no, I'm good. So Murphy insisted pushing him back inside the warehouse, where he too was hit in the back of the head with the axe handle. Both men were bound, pillowcased, and put into the electrical room.
Oh man.
At 12:45, another CO came into the office to get a hitch for a utility vehicle.
So are they just going to hang out here until the entire prison is in the electrical room?
It almost seems like it, right?
Okay.
But I think what they were doing, it's not clear, but I think that we were doing is they were waiting for anybody who was going to be coming into the maintenance department at any point after lunch. So they were waiting for all of those, that like the kind of flood of supervisors, COs or whatever, to get things or to just come back and, you know, be in the supervising department to continue with their job. And they were just waiting for people to just keep cycling in. And then they were just taking them down one by one.
They're looking for the supervisors in like a shift rollover.
Yeah. Until they had everybody together and everybody bound and under their control, and then they can move on to their next phase of their plan. So this CO was coming into the office to get a hitch for a utility vehicle in order to haul some lumber. Again, he saw unsupervised prisoners, and again, he wasn't all that worried about it. He asked to see their supervisor, and they told him he was in the warehouse. As he looked around for the supervisor, he noticed a handheld radio and a set of keys laying on the floor. He barely had time to register this before he was attacked from behind by three men and shoved to the ground. One put a knife blade to his face, but the CEO grabbed the blade, bending it back and away from him before he was again hit in the head with the axe handle. Then to add insult to injury, he was cuffed with his own handcuffs.
Aye.
Yeah. He was bound with tape and thrown into the electrical room. The time was now 1 o'clock, and yet another supervisor entered the maintenance department with another uninvolved inmate. The supervisor immediately noticed that a white Texas Department of Criminal Justice maintenance truck was sitting in the shop, and the overhead door to the bay was closed and locked. He knew something wasn't right, as vehicles were never allowed in this area unless for a specific duty, like collecting or moving materials. And even then, the door would be open. As he was just standing there, kind of puzzled, Newberry came up to him, wielding a 10 to 12 inch long piece of metal that had been sharpened on both edges like a freaking short sword.
Jeez.
Yeah. This guy has, Sting up in there trying to get him. The supervisor shoved him away, saying, "You better stop while you're ahead." Clearly not taking Newberry seriously and not realizing the danger he was in.
Oh, hell no.
That's weird to me, because if you came up to me with a foot-long short sword, I'd be like, oh, Shay has finally had enough of me and he's trying to kill me. So, I mean, that's my husband. And I would be like, oh, God, this is my death. So if a prisoner...
Stop, don't say it like that. I wouldn't do that, first of all.
But I'm just saying, if you did, I'd be like, oh, you're trying to kill me. If a prisoner at the prison I worked with had a 12-inch blade and was... brandishing at me, I'd be like, oh, clearly something's wrong. But
yeah, you're saying I'm no hardened criminal, and even if I had it, you'd be like, oh my gosh.
My joke. Yep. Thanks.
Yep. I'm gonna keep explaining it. You want one more explanation?
No, I'm good. To show him it wasn't a joke, Newberry came up behind him and put the blade against his throat, saying, "I'm very serious. I don't want to hurt you, but I will if you don't lie down and cooperate."
Cooperate.
Yeah, I mean, what else are you gonna do? There's nothing else you're gonna do.
Unless you have specific training to know how to take it away, you're just gonna cooperate.
Exactly, and a lot of these people did not have specific training for this. So Halpern and Newberry tied his hands and feet, gave him the old pillowcase treatment. And
is that what we're calling it now?
Exactly. And they put him into the electrical room. Meanwhile, Murphy attacked the other prisoner and ended up stabbing him in the finger. Rivas and Garcia tied him up and put him in the electrical room with the others.
Wait, stabbed him in the finger?
Yeah, and I don't really know if it was just like, like an intentional stab of the finger, if it was just like in their tussle.
Give me your finger. It's really hard to purposely stab someone in the finger.
I would think. I don't know exactly what happened, but I know that he ended up getting a gash in his finger. Now, at this point, they had taken 14 men hostage, including 9 maintenance supervisors, 2 corrections officers, and 3 prisoners. And remember, one of these men apparently was Leslie 0902's cousin.
Oh, my gosh. As far as I know. That's right.
Which is insane.
Oh, my gosh. Which one of them was the cousin?
I don't know.
I feel so bad for all these correctional officers.
I feel very bad for them as well. As well you should. Now, the 7 decided that they had just successfully secured the warehouse now and could move on with the second phase of their plan. They secured the door to the electrical room, thinking that all 14 men were safely tucked inside, still bound and gagged and unable to raise an alarm. Mm-hmm. However, unbeknownst to them, one of the supervisors in the electrical room had been able to struggle free from his bonds. Another supervisor carried a pocket knife that the prisoners hadn't found on him, and both men began to free the other hostages. except for the one CEO, obviously, who had been handcuffed.
Oh, man, he's dead to rights.
Yeah. I know. Now, free to fight back, the hostages began tearing electrical conduit from the walls and using it to barricade the door to ensure that the seven couldn't re-enter the electrical room.
Oh.
The sound of the conduit being torn down alerted the seven, who then tried to get back into the room to re-secure the hostages. A standoff of sorts occurred, with the seven pushing against the door, trying to force their way in, and the hostages struggling desperately to hold the door while still barricading it, afraid that if the prisoners got in, they'd just kill them all.
Yeah, yeah. And then I'm guessing some of them aren't out of their bindings yet.
Not all of them, especially the one CEO with the handcuffs.
So it's like a tug of war situation.
Yeah, absolutely it was. But finally, the seven realized that they wouldn't be able to enter the room and they were just wasting time. After all, as long as the hostages couldn't get out, they were still pretty ineffective, locked in the room anyway, even if they were no longer bound.
Yeah.
So they grabbed a hand-operated winch and winched the door to the electrical room closed, ensuring their hostages couldn't escape.
Huh. That's really smart on their part.
Yeah. These are smart guys. These are smart and capable criminals. Absolutely.
But you know what? It served to the correctional officers and the supervisors to save them.
Well, they try another little thing here.
Oh.
We're going to get to that in just a second. So just after 1 o'clock, a phone call came into the maintenance department. Not wanting to raise suspicions by letting it go unanswered, Rivas answered the phone and realized it was a CO at Central Control calling to ask for a headcount. Now, obviously, if you're of a prison, you have multiple headcounts that come through every day where you actually physically count, you know, X number of prisoners who are under your control or under your area. That way you can report back to them and you can make sure that, you know, prisoners are all where they should be.
Yeah.
He put another one of the prisoners on the phone to impersonate their supervisor and gave the count at 10. So this number would include all seven of the escaping inmates, plus the three that they had captured who were stuck in the electrical room. So basically, they wanted to make sure that the numbers they reported were correct to ensure that no one would realize that there was anything off.
Sure.
Realizing they were trapped, at this point, the hostages made a last-ditch effort to alert the prison about what was happening. One of the supervisors set off the fire alarm in the electrical room, hoping that this would be enough to signal something was wrong or at least provide reason for someone to come check out the area.
Yeah, that seems like a decent idea.
It really does. But the central control officer saw the alarm and made a few calls to the maintenance department, but couldn't get a response.
Because everybody in the maintenance department is locked in the electrical closet.
Exactly. So instead of sending anyone to check out the building, she went ahead and just assumed it was a false alarm and silenced it from the control panel.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
What?
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Now, in the breakout episode that you can watch, it suggests that there were often false alarms in this area. But, you know, this is the maintenance base, so you have, like, sawdust and metal fragments and everything going on, and that this was in the electrical room, and that there were a lot of false alarms from this area, and that maybe, again, it was an assumption. You know, we've had 6 false alarms in the past month. I'm just going to go ahead and assume this is a false alarm as well. Now, I didn't see that exactly anywhere, but I think that makes sense.
That's a good point to make. Yeah,
I think that makes sense if, got a rusty old bucket of a building and you got a false alarm and I'm just going to go ahead and silence it because I'm going to make the assumption that it's just another false alarm. So
there's just so many red flags that are popping up.
Exactly. Now let's switch gears for just a second and go to the back gate picket and radio tower area of the compound. The picket is the area located between the compound and the back gate of the prison. It's sort of like a gatekeeping area made to ensure that no one without the proper clearance can even get near the back gate. It's this little narrow area completely fenced in and all topped with razor wire. Next to the gate picket is what's called a sally port. This is an even more tightly controlled passageway that's separate from the picket gate. It's also completely fenced in, and it was used by prisoners that might be passing through the gate picket. So, for example, if a prisoner was in a vehicle that was going through the gate picket, the prisoner would have to get out of the vehicle and pass through the sally port by foot and they meet up with the vehicle on the other side, even if they were cleared to exit or enter the area. And these were just extra security protocols for this area of the prison. So at about 1:15, the COs manning the picket gate and the Sally Port gate both received phone calls. The person on the other end of the line claimed to be a worker from the maintenance department who was alerting the gate security that a maintenance crew was on its way to install cameras in the picket area. Now, this seemed like a perfectly reasonable work order because both COs knew that cameras had just been installed in another gate picket in another part of the prison.
Oh, so they're getting new cameras updated.
Exactly. Oh. So not only was this not a surprise to them, but it was actually kind of expected. At 1:40 p.m., Rivas and Halperin showed up at the picket gate in a utility vehicle called a gator, but it's really just kind of like a little golf cart.
Yeah.
Rivas and Halperin had dressed themselves in some of the clothing they had stolen from the supervisors that they had attacked, and they appeared as civilian maintenance workers ready to install the cameras. With them was two of the other prisoners, one of which was Murphy, the other one we're not sure about who it was, but both of these men were still in their prison uniforms. Now, the other three members of the group stayed behind in the maintenance department to keep watch and to also enact other parts of the plan.
This is so elaborate.
It's very elaborate, exactly. Now, the two men still dressed as prisoners proceeded on to the Sally Port gate, which would have been expected from them. Because of the phone call which had informed the CO at the gate to expect a maintenance team to arrive, Halpin and Rivas were, quote-unquote, expected, and instead of inspecting their identification and confirming their identities, the CO opened the picket gate and allowed the men to enter on the gator. Rivas and Halperin parked the gator and entered the gatehouse carrying boxes filled with cameras, monitoring equipment, and electrical wire. Basically everything they need to make the installation believable.
That's so smart.
Exactly. They then opened the Sally Port gate and allowed the prisoners to enter. Right away, Halperin set to putting the CO at ease while simultaneously distracting him from asking for his identification. So basically he set to work like examining the electrical outlets in the area and chatting to the CO and kind of just being like this, oh, blah, 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 I'm going to talk about my day or whatever. And immediately after that, the phone rang and Halperin answered it. The caller identified himself as a maintenance supervisor and asked if the maintenance crew had arrived yet. Really? Of course, this was one of the other prisoners back in the maintenance department calling to confirm that phase two of the plan was well on its way and that Rivas and Halperin had gotten through to the gate.
So they had thought that far ahead to have someone call to double down on the fact, like, if something had gone awry and, like, someone had detected that maybe something's not right, then there's a call. Yep. To show that they are officially there. This is call number
one. So we're going to get another checkup in a minute here. Halperin then handed the phone to the CO, but as the CO bent to pick up the receiver, Rivas grabbed the man and forced him to the floor. They took off his uniform, tied him up, taped his mouth closed with duct tape, and locked him in the bathroom. Next, Halperin went down to the exterior gate and called out that he was a maintenance worker who needed through. The CO was the other man who had received the phone call about the phony maintenance crew. So not only was he expecting workers, but earlier in the day, he had seen one of the maintenance workers dressed in the same clothes and hat that Halperin was now wearing.
Oh my gosh.
So he just assumed it was the same man. So the CO let Halperin through the other side of the picket gate and Halperin entered the guard tower. And basically, the whole plan was repeated once again. One of the guys back in the maintenance department now called the tower and asked to speak to the maintenance team. Halperin answered the phone, giving the men back in the maintenance department the signal that they had now infiltrated the guard tower. As he spoke, he saw a .357 revolver lying on the desk.
Lying on the desk?
Yep, was just like hanging out there. He picked up the gun, pointed it at the CO, and told him, "This is an escape. You need to cooperate if you don't want to get hurt." Below, Murphy, still in his prison uniform, yelled up at Halperin to go ahead and open the gate. Halperin told the CO to do so, or he would kill him. So basically, Halperin couldn't figure out the controls, so he was now threatening the CO to open the gate to allow Murphy to go through. So the whole time, he's keeping his gun on the officer. After forcing the CO to open the gate, Halperin told him to show him where the guns were kept, because again, we're in the guard tower now where all of the weapons are stored.
They're going to arm them, aren't they?
Yep. The CO took him to the bottom of the tower to show him the weapons locker, and Halperin tied the CO up with his own belt and his own shoestrings. Halperin and Murphy then collected the weapons. There was a shotgun, an AR-15, and 14 357 revolvers, and tons of ammunition for each of these weapons.
14 revolvers?
That's right. Halperin then called back to the maintenance department and told the rest of the seven that it was their time to get the hell out. The three who had stayed behind in the maintenance building loaded up in the white Texas Department of Criminal Justice truck that they had brought into the warehouse.
Oh my gosh.
Earlier that day, Rivas had constructed a sort of shelter, or it was kind of like a truck bed cover made of plywood and cardboard. So this was almost like a short table that you could rest in the bed of the truck, to where it looked like there was just a flat piece of wood or whatever at the top of the bed, but it was enough space underneath it to hide human bodies.
It's like a truck bed cover. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, yeah. Basically like a truck bed cover that they made out of plywood and cardboard.
And they had lots of things to make stuff with because they're in the maintenance facility.
Yeah, exactly. Now, this structure was loaded into the bed of the truck, and those prisoners still dressed in their prison uniforms hid underneath this shelter. And this way, the prisoners could hide from view from anyone within the compound who might be in the area, but they could also hide as they left the compound and drove into town. Mm-hmm. The truck drove down to the gate area, picked up their four remaining members, and drove out of the compound and into the little town of Kennedy.
Wow, so they're out now?
They're out.
Oh my gosh, they're out.
The seven said with each passing mile, as the prison disappeared further and further behind them, it was as if a great weight was lifted off their shoulders. They all began thanking God, who they truly believed had helped in their escape from prison, and began reciting the Lord's Prayer. Now, I am not a religious acolyte. What's the term of a person who knows a lot about religion? I am not a religious scholar.
There you go. Yeah.
But I'm going to say that I don't think God had anything to do with a serial rapist, another rapist, a child abuser, and a bunch of robbers escaping from prison.
Especially all the terror that they put those maintenance workers, supervisors, and COs through.
Yeah, I feel like maybe God hopefully should have other things on his mind than letting these pieces of crap escape. The time was about 2 p.m., and all in all, it took the Texas 7 roughly 2.5 hours to escape this maximum security prison.
Oh my God, 2.5 hours.
That's right. Besides a few bloody noses, bruised bodies, and a few other injuries, not a single person was seriously injured in the escape.
I mean, we've almost spent 2.5 hours talking about it.
It feels like it, right?
Gosh, they accomplished so much.
I know. But the seven couldn't help but leave a little piece of themselves behind, and that came in the form of three letters that they left for prison workers to find.
Wait.
Now, unfortunately, I can't find the full details of the three letters anywhere. I think they were taken by the TDJC as evidence, and I'm not sure that they were ever released to the media.
Oh.
So all we have is just a few general details about what was in these letters. In one, they railed against the Texas prison system and stated that they wanted to spark an uprising amongst the inmates at the Connolly unit. I would like to point out the three prisoners that they took captive and threw in the electrical closet like everybody else. So, I mean, clearly they weren't that nice to the other prisoners.
Yeah.
They were really looking out for number one.
Mm-hmm. They're a little hell-bent for leather at that point.
That's right. Nice Judas Priest. Is that Judas Priest?
Hell-bent for leather.
There you go. Another included a line from a Kris Kristofferson song saying,
no.
Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose.
Oh my gosh. Not Kris Kristofferson.
Yep. And the third note rather ominously stated, you haven't heard the last of us yet. Back at the guard tower, one of the COs was able to free himself and make the distress call describing the escape of the prisoners. He knew that they were in the white TDCJ truck, and straight away a bolo for the truck was issued to the police officers in the area.
What's a bolo?
Be on the lookout.
Oh, okay. Yep.
That God, who are you that you don't know what a bolo is? You,
I have struck you
from the true crime community.
I just remembered. I was thinking like a bolo tie. Like,
oh my God. Oh my God, guys. Sorry,
be on the lookout. No, where this is all getting cut.
Leave this in. You don't know what a bolo
engineer.
Is.
I'm the engineer.
Law enforcement was organized to keep watch for the truck and the escaped convicts all over town, and practically every road in town was shut down with checkpoints set up to verify identities and search vehicles. At 4 o'clock, about 2 hours after the escapees fled the compound, the white TDCJ truck was found abandoned in the local Walmart parking lot in Kennedy. The only security footage in the area was an ATM that was vaguely pointed in the right direction, and from the very poor footage that they could get from it, it appeared as if the men exited the truck and got into a dark two-door compact car and drove off. In reality, this was actually a dark SUV that they had driven off in.
That makes more sense. How are you going to fit 7 people into a tiny compact?
Exactly. There were no reports of stolen cars in the area, so it was speculated at the time that they had helped to get access to this getaway vehicle.
Ooh.
And it was later learned that Michael Rodriguez's father, Raul Rodriguez, had indeed been involved to some degree in the planning of the escape and had left the car for them. Over the next 24 hours, the town of Kennedy was at a standstill waiting for the 7 to be found. An apartment building nearby the Walmart was evacuated and searched to ensure the escapees weren't holed up with hostages inside. Tracking dogs, helicopters, and law enforcement from all around were brought in to try to find a trace of the 7 men. But eventually, law enforcement had to admit that they had no idea where the 7 were or where they were headed.
So this suburban SUV, dark colored, got through the checkpoint somehow.
Yeah, and most likely they probably just left town before these checkpoints were able to be put up.
They were too quick.
They were too quick. Now, the assumption was that the convicts would split up, try to hunker down for a short period of time before contacting family members, friends, ex-girlfriends, etc. After all, this is historically what happens with prison escapees, and it usually leads to their relatively quick arrests. They also thought that probably the most likely plan of action would be to travel south and to try to cross the border into Mexico. But the Texas 7 didn't play by the books, and they ended up doing neither one of the things expected of them by the authorities. Authorities would have to sit on their heels and wait for the 7 to do something stupid or violent enough to draw their attention and help track them down. And yes, stupid violence does come into play in this story, and we will learn more about that in part 2 of The Texas 7.
Oh, is that it?
Is
that the end of the episode? Oh, man.
That is it.
Oh, we got to know more about what happens. We're just going to have to tune in next week.
Why do you sound so disappointed?
Well, I want to do it now. I want to cover it now, but
I'm sorry.
We can't.
You're just going to have to wait and just with everybody else.
Yeah, I'm with you, audience. I'm with you, True Crime Posse. We all want to know what happens. I'm suffering with you. It's like when you're watching a really good show and you catch up on it and you're watching it live.
Oh, and then it gets that like,
yeah, I'm your friend.
To be continued episode. And you're like, no.
Yeah. All right. Are we ready to have our closing thoughts about this first episode? What a prison break.
Yeah.
It's like a
pretty convoluted.
It's MacGyver gone wrong.
It's simple and yet
effective.
So yeah, so effective.
But man, yes, it was so successful.
Yeah.
And I found it interesting. Just, I would love to know if that cousin is one of those people in the
Leslie 0902.
Gosh.
Get in touch.
Oh man.
We want to know.
We do. Do you have any closing statements on episode on part 1 of this Lone Star Lunatic series on the Texas 7?
No. So that's the story, and we'll be getting into the rest of it. I have so much more to cover. I'm actually really quite worried about getting it all done in just 2 episodes, but I'm going to try my best.
Well, you've been working your ass off, and I think it shows in episode 1. It was really good, and I think episode 2 is even going to be better. And this is, like we said earlier, it's going to dovetail into my next series really well. We're going to talk about the prison system yet again, but it's going to be a different time period, and you're going to get to see a window into this episode series. It's going to be great. Are you ready for some good news?
I have never been more ready for anything in my life.
Cue the music, Aaron. So our good news today comes from Tomball, Texas. This is a story about a three-year-old boy who was from Tomball, and he lost his favorite stuffed animal. And thanks to his family and the use of, what do we always talk about, Aaron?
Social media.
Oh, the power of social media. It's so powerful. It's going to solve the world's problems one day. Because this little three-year-old boy, he lost his favorite stuffed animal, right? And it's like this little brown dog stuffed toy. Carter Smith, he doesn't have his furry friend anymore. And it's from this H-E-B store, which I don't know if people outside of Texas know what H-E-B is. But it's kind of this small little version of a Walmart. Like, you can get kind of everything there at an H-E-B. And people love H-E-B. They go crazy for H-E-B, especially outside of big cities. Well, anyways, his family, they contact the president of H-E-B because they've been running around trying to find another one of these stuffed dogs, which he had named Toby. So it's this little Toby.
Toby!
Yeah, Toby. Isn't Toby the name of the little boy in The Labyrinth?
Yes, thank you. And exactly also, what my reference was.
And Nelson, we dressed up as Toby
yes!
one year.
Yes! I was Sarah, and you were Jareth.
I was
and
Jareth.
And Nelson was Toby.
I was the most ugly Jareth you could ever imagine.
Would never make a beautiful woman.
No, it was terrifying.
And I did your makeup. How are your eyebrows so low? That's all I'm going to ask.
But our outfits were on point. It's just I was really ugly. Everybody else looked great. This little stuffed animal from H-E-B went missing. Its name was Toby. And the family went crazy. And Carter, he was inconsolable without Toby. It was his favorite toy. It was gone. It was missing. The president of H-E-B, they were kind of thinking, you know, we're going to send out this hashtag, bring Toby home, as just kind of a joke. Well, he actually jumped on the ball and was like, no, we're going to find another Toby for Carter. Turns out they had stopped production of Toby. So what H-E-B did to go get this actual stuffed animal was they went back to the original manufacturer and they got them to custom make another one of these little stuffed animals, and they surprised Carter and his family with it at an H-E-B, and it's super touching. Like, the little kid, it's like his eyes light up and his whole life has changed. Like, it's his favorite stuffed animal, he's got it back, and he just won't let it go through like the entire news interview. It's really cute. So we'll have to share that video from Tomball, Texas. And that's it. That's all I got. Do you have anything to say about that?
I remember my favorite stuffed animal when I was growing up was a little fat bear that I got for Valentine's Day. And it was a white bear and it had like red things on it. And it wore like a little red jumpsuit with little hearts on it. And I named her Blueberry.
Why?
Because that's just how I am. What was your favorite stuffed animal growing up?
My stuffed animal growing up was a big giant, it was giant to me at the time. It was a pretty large sized teddy bear. But what was unique about it was it had a recording device in it. And it actually had a recording that you could turn on and it sounded like the mother's heartbeat if you were in the womb. And it sounds kind of weird. It actually was really soothing. It was like this, like weird little.
Ew,
like,
what kind of condition does that person have? That is not what a heartbeat sounds like.
It was just like vibrate.
That's what my heart sounds like with all the tacos and burritos I eat.
Well, it was this vibrating, like, you know, just repetitive noise over and over. It was soothing for a little baby, you know, and that was my stuffed animal.
Weird. Mine's better.
I don't feel like it's as interesting.
Okay.
God. Oh, man. Well, that was a short good news, but it brought some levity to the
lovely.
Podcast.
I like, yeah. Yeah. It was nice.
Are you ready for some international 5-star iTunes reviews?
Oh, yeah. So we noticed that all of the reviews that we've been reading lately have all been from our U.S. iTunes thing. And if you didn't know this, and I didn't know this until we started our own podcast, iTunes splits up their reviews and their rating sections up by country. So therefore, if you are in the United States and you're just checking your iTunes reviews, you're only seeing reviews from other people within the United States. So you actually have to go through and change the settings and blah, blah, blah in order to find reviews and ratings from other countries. And so we have ratings from other countries. We would like to read those off for you guys as well, because you know what? We love our international listeners. You guys are brilliant.
Internationale, speciale.
And we are going to be, at least as far as it'll take us, we're going to be reading these reviews in the accent of the reviewee.
Oh, man.
I'm going to do Canada because that's the easiest. Oh.
Okay, what country am I doing?
I don't know. We'll see when we get to it.
Okay. All right. Give me your best Canada.
Okay. Our first Canadian review comes from BHGCHU. Is that a Canadian thing? It says, love your podcast, great stories, keep up the good work, Kim. Thank you, Kim, BHGCHU.
Wait, where's your accent?
Canadians don't have accents unless when it comes to certain things. And if these certain words come up in the podcast,
in these reviews,
then I'm going to read them in that way.
This was this was very highly pitched, very lowly delivered.
Joe Bagadoogie.
Bagadoogie.
Says, good job, eh? There's my little Canadian coming through right there. Excellent job, you two. I'm a long-haul truck driver from Canada driving to Laredo every week, and I just finished binge-listening all your programs. You sound great, almost like you've been doing it all your lives. Keep up the good work. There are no punctuation because I'm doing voice-to-text. Which I love the idea that he's doing voice-to-text because he's driving.
Yeah.
He's keeping his hands on 10 and 2, driving from Canada to Laredo.
Yeah.
And he's got his business to take care of. He's doing his job.
I love the idea of a long-haul.
Thank you, Joe Bagadoogie.
I love the idea of a long-haul Canadian trucker just listening to us.
Yes.
As he's going through Alberta with some cattle or, like, just some produce.
Who knows? I hope it's some kind of Canadian, specialty.
Like poutine?
Yeah, just bags and bags of poutine. And
or like maple syrup. And,
yep. And yeah.
Moose knuckles.
In my mind's eye, that's what he's doing. All right, moose knuckles. That's not a thing. All right, Lolly55 says, all crime, no cattle, Texas crime. I found it through your friends at Dark Poutine.
Oh, they are our friends. We love Dark Poutine.
Yes, we do. Love you both. I binged on all the episodes. Keep up the good work. Coming from Kelowna, BC, Canada. Also, there is no cursing. Love your pups. And then a bunch of flower and Canadian flag emojis.
I still don't detect enough hint of your Canadian accent.
Because they speak exactly the same. Now, had there been an oot or a boot or a sorry, then, you know, maybe it would have been more obvious.
Are you done?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm going to really do an accent on mine.
Oh, okay.
I'm doing Australia.
Oh, Australia, put another shrimp on the bobby.
Oh, man, like they haven't heard that a million times.
I'm sorry, I cannot do an accent.
All right, here we go. This one's from D16-1984.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you say mm-hmm?
Oh, like, I'm
you
just know really who that excited is. For oh. your accent upcoming.
This one is, hi, from Oz. You're doing an excellent job. Keep it up. 5 stars.
That was good. Good job. And thank you. Who was it?
D16-1984.
Oh, thank you. We'll cut that.
All right. The next one comes from Lorena74. She says, awesome. Love you guys. Started binging yesterday. And I love your work. So natural. Great topics. 10 out of 10.
Oh my God. Australia's going to stop listening to us completely.
All right. Australians, hit us up in the comments. Get us on our Facebook
page. How is Shay's accent?
Yeah. I feel like I'm doing
it.
1 out of 10. I feel like I'm impeccably doing an Australian accent.
I feel like they're going to have some issues with that. All right, one more Australian.
All right, the next one's from Claire. You remember in Lost?
Yes.
With, there was the...
Get away from my baby, Charlie.
You don't know, I love you and your baby, Claire. I saved you in the ocean, Claire.
Oh my God.
All right, so this one comes from Claire LJ86. Great new podcast. 5 stars. Really enjoying All Crime No Cattle. Just listened to the second episode and looking forward to more.
You are so pleased with yourself. Great. Now we're offending people across the world.
All right. What country's next?
I'm going to do Great Britain.
Oh, all right. This is your famous Cockney accent.
Yes. Well, it's the only Great British accent I could do.
The only Great British accent you can do.
Shut up. We only have a couple from UK, so that's probably good because you're going to be all angry at my accent. But I'm going to go ahead and start it. This is from Chelsea Blobs.
That's not bad.
Thank you. I've been looking for a new crime podcast for a while.
Oh, no. It just fell apart.
Hold on, I gotta get in the mindset. I've been looking for a new true crime podcast for a while now, and I'm so happy to have stumbled upon All Crime No Cattle. The balance between facts and banter is perfect, and it's great to hear about cases that are rarely discussed elsewhere.
Oh, wow.
5 stars.
You finished that up rather nicely, I must say.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chelsea Blobs. The next one is from not_chi, perhaps Kai. And they say, love ACNC. Just found and binge listened to this great podcast. I love the easy banter between Erin and Shay. They cover some cases that I've heard of, but most that I've not, which is a nice change. It's also nice that I can look at the pictures on Instagram while Erin and Shay explain what it is and why it's significant. Keep up the great work from Nottingham.
You sound like one of the judges from the Great British Bake Off show.
Thank you. That's what I'm going for, because I've been binging that show lately, if you were wondering. That wasn't that bad. I'm actually quite proud of myself. I apologize to everyone in the land of Great Britain. All right. And our last international review that we are going to be reading today is from New Zealand. I apologize just straight out the gate. I'm sorry, New Zealand.
Oh, now we're going to apologize?
No, I've been apologizing the whole time, believe me. Mel's Bells says, loving it. Thanks for the awesome podcast. I'm loving it and can't wait for more.
It still sounds like Australian to me, but that's okay.
Oh, it's not. Well, I mean, that's better than it being close. Different.
Yeah.
Than in any other pot, you know, accent
I'm sorry,
I can
New
do.
Zealanders. I know that offends you that we're relating you to Australia.
And I just really like to do accents because I'm terrible at them. I literally am the worst at accents.
It might make you feel better, New Zealand, that we really love Jermaine Clement and Brett of Flight of the Conchords. I hope that makes you feel better.
I don't know. Yeah. Eventually, we got to wrap up this episode, though.
We're done. That's it. We're out.
So thank you to all of our reviewers. Again, remember, everyone across this great earth, if you give us a 5-star review on iTunes or on Facebook, we will read your brilliant review on our podcast with our great thanks.
And our horrible accents.
And possibly our horrible accents.
Also, where can you find us, Aaron?
You can find us on Instagram at All Crime No Cattle. You can find us on Twitter at ACNC Podcast. And if you look on Facebook and you just search All Crime No Cattle, you can find our Facebook page.
You can
and it's lovely, and you should just go ahead and like that.
You can also email us with your questions, comments, and
dumb remarks.
Yep, at allcrimenocattle@gmail.com. And our main website, which also has links to everything, is allcrimenocattle.podbean.com. And you can use our Gmail account that we mentioned earlier to give us a tip if you like. We have a Threadless shop where you can get those magical totes that we talked about earlier.
Totes my goats.
Totes my goats. And, oh, up quick, we have an Australian podcast as our featured podcast this week. It is True Crime Island, hosted by our friend, our podcasting compatriot from across the world, Cambo. And he loves to introduce his episodes as such. Crack yourself a beer open, grab yourself a deck chair. It's time for some True Crime Island, and I'm Cambo. And I feel like that's
actually really good.
Yeah. I love
it. I mean, to my ears, it's really good. I bet he is horribly offended.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Cambo. You're great.
Cambo, but do your interpretation of us.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah.
But no, True Crime Island is really great. It's a single narration type podcast, but it's got none of the pretentiousness that sometimes those single host narrated podcasts can
it's
have.
It's laid back. It's fun. He's crass.
Yeah, and it's interesting. And he's covered a lot of really interesting stories, and he's got quite a backlog. I think he's on like episode 30 something.
Yeah.
So, you know, tons of stuff to binge, and it's a really great podcast. We really love it, and we like him.
Yeah, and it's time to wrap this baby up, and I think that's a nice bow to put on it. We're running out of time, so from us, from the Canine Crime Unit, and the ACNC True Crime Posse, from Detective Shea Butter to District Attorney Aaron, we are out of here. So always remember, that crime is bigger in Texas, y'all. Adios.
Bye.
Get mad when listening to true crime? Well, so do I. If you want a weekly true crime podcast that says what you're thinking, then grab a beer and pull up a deck chair. This is Cambo from True Crime Island, another true crime podcast, and maintain the rage with me. Visit truecrimeisland.com where you can download or stream each episode. Plus, there's links to iTunes and social media. And as I always say, don't forget to delete your browser history. This is True Crime Island.